My Grandmother Millard and General Bedford Forrest and the Battle of Harrican Creek. 1. It would be right after supper, before we had left the table. At first, beginning with the day the news came that the Yankees had taken Memphis, we did it 3 nights in succession. But after that, as we got better and better and faster, once a week suited Granny. Then, after Cousin Melisandre finally got out of Memphis and came to live with us, it would be just once a month. And when the regiment in Virginia voted Father out of the colonelcy, and he came home and stayed 3 months while he made a crop and got over his mad and organized his cavalry troop for General Forrest's command, we quit doing it at all. That is, we did it one time with Father there, too, watching. And that night, Ringo and I heard him laughing in the library, the first time he had laughed since he came home, until in about a half a minute, Granny came out already holding her skirts up and went sailing up the stairs. So we didn't do it anymore until Father had organized his troop and was gone again. Granny would fold her napkin beside her plate. She would speak to Ringo, standing behind her chair, without even turning her head.
Go call Joby and Lucius.
And Ringo would go back through the kitchen without stopping. He would just say, All right, look out. At Luvinia's back, and go to the cabin, and come back with not only Joby and Lucius and the lighted lantern, but Philadelphia too, even though Philadelphia wasn't going to do anything but stand and watch, and then follow to the orchard, and back to the house, until Granny said we were done for that time and she and Lucius could go back home to bed. And we would bring down from the attic the big trunk. We had done it so many times by now that we didn't even need the lantern anymore to go to the attic and get the trunk, whose lock it was my job to oil every Monday morning with a feather dipped in chicken fat. And Luvinia would come in from the kitchen with the unwashed silver from supper in a dishpan under one arm and the kitchen clock under the other, and set the clock and the dishpan on the table, and take from her apron pocket a pair of Granny's rolled-up stockings, and hand them to Granny. And Granny would unroll the stockings and take from the toe of one of them a wadded rag, and open the rag and take out the key to the trunk, and unpin her watch from her bosom and fold it into the rag and put the rag back into the stocking and roll the stockings back into a ball and put the ball into the trunk. Then with Cousin Melisandre and Philadelphia watching, and Father too on that one time when he was there, Granny would stand facing the clock, her hands raised and about 8 inches apart, and her neck bowed so she could watch the clock face over her spectacles, until the big hand reached the nearest hour mark. The rest of us watched her hands. She wouldn't speak again. She didn't need to. There would be just the single light, loud pop of her palms when the hand came to the nearest hour mark. Sometimes we would be already moving, even before her hands came together. All of us, that is, except Philadelphia. Granny wouldn't let her help at all, because of Lucius. Even though Lucius had done nearly all the digging of the pit and did most of the carrying of the trunk each time. But Philadelphia had to be there. Granny didn't have to tell her but once.
I want the wives of all the free men here, too, Granny said. I want all of you free folks to watch what the rest of us that ain't free have to do to keep that way.
That began about 8 months ago. One day, even I realized that something had happened to Lucius. Then I knew that Ringo had already seen it, and that he knew what it was, so that when at last Luvinia came and told Granny, it was not as if Lucius had dared his mother to tell her, but as if he had actually forced somebody, he didn't care who, to tell her. He had said it more than once, in the cabin one night probably for the first time, then after that in other places and to other people, to Negroes from other plantations even. Memphis was already gone then, and New Orleans, and all we had left of the river was Vicksburg, and although we didn't believe it then, we wouldn't have that long. Then one morning Luvinia came in where Granny was cutting down the worn-out uniform pants Father had worn home from Virginia so they would fit me, and told Granny how Lucius was saying that soon the Yankees would have all of Mississippi and Yaknapatawpha County, too. and all the niggers would be free, and that when that happened, he was going to be long gone. Lucius was working in the garden that morning. Granny went out to the back gallery, still carrying the pants and the needle. She didn't even push her spectacles up. She said, "You, Lucius," just once. And Lucius came out of the garden with the hoe, and Granny stood looking down at him over the spectacles as she looked over them at everything she did, from reading or sewing to watching the clock face, until the instant came to start burying the silver.
"You can go now," she said. "You needn't wait on the Yankees."
"Go?" Lucius said. "I ain't free."
"You've been free for almost 3 minutes,"
Granny said.
"Go on."
Lucius blinked his eyes, while you could have counted about 10.
"Go where?"
he said.
"I can't tell you," Granny said. "I ain't free. I would imagine you will have all Yankeedom to move around in."
Lucius blinked his eyes. He didn't look at Granny now.
"Was that all you wanted?" he said.
"Yes,"
Granny said. So he went back to the garden, and that was the last we heard about being free from him. That is, it quit showing in the way he acted. And if he talked any more of it, even Lavinia never thought it was worth bothering Granny with. It was Granny who would do the reminding of it, especially to Philadelphia, especially on the nights when we would stand like racehorses at the barrier, watching Granny's hands until they clapped together. Each one of us knew exactly what he was to do. I would go upstairs for Granny's gold hatpin and her silver-headed umbrella and her plumed Sunday hat, because she had already sent her earrings and brooch to Richmond a long time ago, and to Father's room for his silver-backed brushes, and to Cousin Melisandre's room after she came to live with us for her things, because the one time Granny let Cousin Melisandre try to help too, Cousin Melisandre brought all her dresses down. Ringo would go to the parlor for the candlesticks and Granny's dulcimer and the medallion of Father's mother back in Carolina. And we would run back to the dining room where Lavinia and Lucius would have the sideboard almost cleared. And Granny, still standing there and watching the clock face and the trunk, both now with her hands ready to pop again, and they would pop. And Ringo and I would stop at the cellar door just long enough to snatch up the shovels and run on to the orchard and snatch the brush and grass and the criss-crossed sticks away and have the pit open and ready by the time we saw them coming. First Lavinia with the lantern, then Joby and Lucius with the trunk, and Granny walking beside it, and Cousin Melisandre and Philadelphia, and on that one time Father walking along and laughing, following behind. And on that first night, the kitchen clock wasn't in the trunk. Granny was carrying it, while Lavinia held the lantern so that Granny could watch the hand. Granny made us put the trunk into the pit and shovel the dirt back and smooth it off and lay the brush and grass back over it again, and then dig up the trunk and carry it back to the house. And one night it seemed like we had been bringing the trunk down from the attic and putting the silver into it and carrying it out to the pit and uncovering the pit and then covering the pit again and turning around and carrying the trunk back to the house and taking the silver out and putting it back where we got it from all winter and all summer too. That night, and I don't know who thought of it first, maybe it was all of us at once. But anyway, the clock hand had passed 4 hour marks before Granny's hands even popped for Ringo and me to run and open the pit. And they came with the trunk, and Ringo and I hadn't even put down the last armful of brush and sticks to save having to stoop to pick it up again. And Lucius hadn't even put down his end of the trunk for the same reason, and I reckon Lavinia was the only one that knew what was coming next, because Ringo and I didn't know that the kitchen clock was still sitting on the dining room table. Then Granny spoke. It was the first time we had ever heard her speak between when she would tell Ringo, "Go call Joby and Lucius," and then tell us both about 30 minutes later, "Wash your feet and go to bed." It was not loud and not long, just 2 words. "Bury it." And we lowered the trunk into the pit, and Joby and Lucius threw the dirt back in, and even then Ringo and I didn't move with the brush until Granny spoke again. Not loud this time either.
"Go on, hide the pit."
And we put the brush back, and Granny said,
"Dig it up."
And we dug up the trunk and carried it back into the house and put the things back where we got them from, and that was when I saw the kitchen clock still sitting on the dining room table. And we all stood there watching Granny's hands until they popped together, and that time we filled the trunk and carried it out to the orchard and lowered it into the pit, quicker than we had ever done before. And then, when the time came to really bury the silver, it was too late. After it was all over, and Cousin Melisandre and Cousin Philip were finally married and Father had got done laughing, Father said that always happened when a heterogeneous collection of people who were cohered simply by an uncomplex will for freedom engaged with the tyrannous machine. He said they would always lose the first battles, and if they were outnumbered and outweighed enough, it would seem to an outsider that they were going to lose them all. But they would not. They could not be defeated. If they just willed that freedom strongly and completely enough to sacrifice all else for it, ease and comfort and fatness of spirit and all, until whatever it was they had left would be enough, no matter how little it was. That very freedom itself would finally conquer the machine as a negative force, like drought or flood, could strangle it. And later still, after 2 more years, and we knew we were going to lose the war, he was still saying that. He said, "I won't see it, but you will. You will see it in the next war, and in all the wars Americans will have to fight from then on. There will be men from the South in the forefront of all the battles, even leading some of them, helping those who conquered us defend that same freedom which they believed they had taken from us." And that happened. 30 years later, and General Wheeler, whom Father would have called apostate, commanding in Cuba, and whom old General Early did call apostate, and matricide, too, in the office of the Richmond editor when he said, "I would like to have lived so that when my time comes I will see Robert Lee again, but since I haven't, I'm certainly going to enjoy watching the devil burn that blue coat off Joe Wheeler." We didn't have time. We didn't even know there were any Yankees in Jefferson, let alone within a mile of Sartoris. There never had been many. There was no railroad then and no river big enough for big boats and nothing in Jefferson they would have wanted even if they had come, since this was before Father had had time to worry them enough for General Grant to issue a general order with a reward for his capture. So we had got used to the war. We thought of it as being definitely fixed and established, as a railroad or a river is, moving east along the railroad from Memphis and south along the river toward Vicksburg. We had heard tales of Yankee pillage, and most of the people around Jefferson stayed ready to bury their silver fast, too, though I don't reckon any of them practiced doing it like we did. But nobody we knew was even kin to anyone who had been pillaged, and so I don't think that even Lucius really expected any Yankees until that morning. It was about 11 o'clock. The table was already set for dinner, and everybody was beginning to kind of ease up, so we would be sure to hear when Lavinia went out to the back gallery and rang the bell, when Ab Snopes came in at a dead run, on a strange horse, as usual. He was a member of Father's troop, not a fighting member. He called himself Father's horse captain, whatever he meant by it, though we had a pretty good idea. And none of us at least knew what he was doing in Jefferson when the troop was supposed to be up in Tennessee with General Bragg, and probably nobody anywhere knew the actual truth about how he got the horse, galloping across the yard and right through one of Granny's flower beds, because I reckon he figured that carrying a message he could risk it, and on around to the back because he knew that, message or no message, he'd better not come to Granny's front door hollering that way, sitting that strange blown horse with a U.S. Army brand on it you could read 300 yards, and yelling up at Granny that General Forrest was in Jefferson, but there was a whole regiment of Yankee cavalry not a half a mile down the road. So we never had time. Afterward, Father admitted that Granny's error was not in strategy, nor tactics either. even though she had copied from someone else. Because he said it had been a long time now since originality had been a component of military success. It just happened too fast. I went for Joby and Lucius and Philadelphia because Granny had already sent Ringo down to the road with a cup towel to wave when they came in sight. Then she sent me to the front window where I could watch Ringo. When Ab Snopes came back from hiding his new Yankee horse, he offered to go upstairs to get the things there. Granny had told us a long time ago never to let Ab Snopes go anywhere about the house unless somebody was with him. She said she would rather have Yankees in the house any day, because at least Yankees would have more delicacy, even if it wasn't anything but good sense, than to steal a spoon or candlestick and then try to sell it to one of her own neighbors, as Ab Snopes would probably do. She didn't even answer him. She just said, "Stand over there by that door and be quiet." So Cousin Melisandre went upstairs after all, and Granny and Philadelphia went to the parlor for the candlesticks and the medallion and the dulcimer. Philadelphia not only helping this time, free or not, but Granny wasn't even using the clock. It just all happened at once. One second Ringo was sitting on the gatepost looking up the road. The next second he was standing on it and waving the cup towel. And then I was running and hollering back to the dining room. And I remember the whites of Joby's and Lucius's and Philadelphia's eyes, and I remembered Cousin Melisandre's eyes where she leaned against the sideboard with the back of her hand against her mouth, and Granny and Luvinia and Ab Snopes glaring at one another across the trunk, and I could hear Luvinia's voice even louder than mine.
"Miss Compson! Miss Compson!"
"What?" Granny cried. "What? Mrs. Compson?"
Then we all remembered. It was when the first Yankee scouting patrol entered Jefferson over a year ago. The war was new then, and I suppose General Compson was the only Jefferson soldier they had heard of yet. Anyway, the officer asked someone in the square where General Compson lived, and old Dr. Holston sent his Negro boy by back alleys and across lots to warn Mrs. Compson in time. And the story was how the Yankee officer sent some of his men through the empty house and himself rode around to the back where old Aunt Roxanne was standing in front of the outhouse behind the closed door of which Mrs. Compson was sitting, fully dressed even to her hat and parasol, on the wicker hamper containing her plate and silver.
"Miss Indah,"
Roxanne said,
"stop where you is."
And the story told how the Yankee officer said, "Excuse me," and raised his hat and even backed the horse a few steps before he turned and called his men and rode away.
"The privy!"
Granny cried.
"Hellfire, Miss Millard,"
Ab Snopes said, and Granny never said anything. It wasn't like she didn't hear because she was looking right at him. It was like she didn't care, that she might have even said it herself. And that shows how things were then. We just never had time for anything.
"Hellfire,"
Ab Snopes said.
"All North Mississippi has done heard about that. There ain't a white lady between here and Memphis that ain't settin' in the back house on a grip full of silver right this minute."
"Then we're already late,"
Granny said.
"Hurry."
"Wait,"
Ab Snopes said.
"Wait. Even them Yankees have done caught on to that by now."
"Then let's hope these are different Yankees,"
Granny said.
"Hurry."
"But Miss Millard,"
Ab Snopes cried.
"Wait, wait."
But then we could hear Ringo yelling down at the gate, and I remember Joby and Lucius and Philadelphia and Luvinia and the balloon-like swaying of Cousin Melisandre's skirts as they ran across the backyard, the trunk somewhere among them. I remember how Joby and Lucius tumbled the trunk into the little, tall, narrow, flimsy sentry box, and Luvinia thrust Cousin Melisandre in and slammed the door, and we could hear Ringo yelling good now, almost to the house. And then I was back at the front window, and I saw them just as they swept around the house in a kind of straggling clump. 6 men in blue, riding fast, yet with something curious in the action of the horses, as if they were not only yoked together in spans, but were hitched to a single wagon tongue. Then Ringo on foot, running and not yelling now. And last of all, the seventh rider, bareheaded and standing in his stirrups, and with a saber over his head. Then I was on the back gallery again, standing beside Granny above that moil of horses and men in the yard. And she was wrong. It was as if these were not only the same ones who had been at Mrs. Compson's last year, but somebody had even told them exactly where our outhouse was. The horses were yoked in pairs, but it was not a wagon tongue. It was a pole, almost a log, 20 feet long, slung from saddle to saddle between the three span. And I remember the faces, unshaven and wan and not so much peering as frantically gleeful, glaring up at us for an instant before the men leaped down and unslung the pole and jerked the horses aside and picked up the pole, 3 to a side, and began to run across the yard with it as the last rider came around the house, in gray. An officer. It was Cousin Philip, though of course we didn't know that then, and there was going to be a considerable more uproar and confusion before he finally became Cousin Philip, and of course we didn't know that either. The saber still lifted, and not only standing in the stirrups, but almost lying down along the horse's neck. The 6 Yankees never saw him, and we used to watch Father drilling his troop in the pasture, changing them from column to troop front at full gallop, and you could hear his voice even above the sound of the galloping hooves, but it wasn't a bit louder than Granny's. "There's a lady in there," she said. But the Yankees never heard her any more than they had seen Cousin Philip yet. The whole mass of them, the 6 men, running with the pole and Cousin Philip on the horse, leaning out above them with a lifted saber, rushing on across the yard until the end of the pole struck the outhouse door. It didn't just overturn. It exploded. One second it stood there, tall and narrow and flimsy. The next second it was gone. And there was a boil of yelling men in blue coats darting and dodging around under Cousin Philip's horse and the flashing saber until they could find a chance to turn and run. Then there was a scatter of planks and shingles and Cousin Melisandre sitting beside the trunk in the middle of it, in the spread of her hoops, her eyes shut and her mouth open, still screaming, and after a while a feeble popping of pistol shots from down along the creek that didn't sound any more like war than a boy with firecrackers.
"I tried to tell you to wait,"
Ab Snopes said behind us.
"I tried to tell you them Yankees had done caught on."
After Joby and Lucius and Ringo and I finished burying the trunk in the pit and hiding the shovel marks, I found Cousin Philip in the summer house. His saber and belt were propped against the wall, but I don't reckon even he knew what had become of his hat. He had his coat off, too, and was wiping it with his handkerchief and watching the house with one eye around the edge of the door. When I came in, he straightened up, and I thought at first he was looking at me. Then I don't know what he was looking at.
"That beautiful girl," he said. "Fetch me a comb."
"They're waiting for you in the house," I said. "Granny wants to know what's the matter."
Cousin Melisandre was all right now. It took Lavinia and Philadelphia both, and finally Granny, to get her into the house, but Lavinia brought the elderflower wine before Granny had time to send her after it, and now Cousin Melisandre and Granny were waiting in the parlor.
"Your sister," Cousin Philip said, "and a hand mirror."
"No, sir," I said.
"She's just our cousin. From Memphis.
Granny says..." Because he didn't know Granny. It was pretty good for her to wait any time for anybody. But he didn't even let me finish.
"That beautiful, tender girl," he said. "And send a nigger with a basin of water and a towel."
I went back toward the house. This time, when I looked back, I couldn't see his eye around the door edge.
"And a clothes brush," he said.
Granny wasn't waiting very much. She was at the front door.
"Now what?" she said.
I told her.
"Does the man think we are giving a ball here in the middle of the day? Tell him I said to come on in and wash on the back gallery like we do. Lavinia's putting dinner on and we're already late."
But Granny didn't know Cousin Philip either. I told her again. She looked at me.
What did he say?
She said.
He didn't say anything, I said. Just that beautiful girl.
That's all he said to me, too, Ringo said. I hadn't heard him come in. Besides the soap and water, just that beautiful girl.
Was he looking at you either when he said it?
I said.
No,
Ringo said. I just thought for a minute he was. Now Granny looked at Ringo and me both.
Ha!
She said. And afterward, when I was older, I found out that Granny already knew Cousin Philip, too. That she could look at one of them and know all the other Cousin Melisandre's and Cousin Philip's both without having to see them.
I sometimes think that bullets are just about the least fatal things that fly, especially in war. All right, she said. Take him his soap and water, but hurry.
We did. This time he didn't say, that beautiful girl. He said it twice. He took off his coat and handed it to Ringo.
Brush it good, he said. Your sister, I heard you say.
No, you didn't, I said.
No matter, he said. I want a nosegay to carry in my hand.
Those flowers are Granny's, I said.
No matter, he said.
He rolled up his sleeves and began to wash.
A small one, about a dozen blooms. Get something pink.
I went and got the flowers. I don't know whether Granny was still at the front door or not. Maybe she wasn't. At least she never said anything. So I picked the ones Ab Snopes's new Yankee horse had already trampled down and wiped the dirt off them and straightened them out and went back to the summer house where Ringo was holding the hand glass while Cousin Philip combed his hair. Then he put on his coat and buckled on his saber again and held his feet out one at a time for Ringo to wipe his boots off with the towel. And Ringo saw it. I wouldn't have spoken at all because we were already later for dinner than ever now, even if there hadn't never been a Yankee on the place.
You tore your britches on them Yankees, Ringo said.
So I went back to the house. Granny was standing in the hall. This time she just said,
Yes.
It was almost quiet.
He tore his britches, I said.
And she knew more about Cousin Philip than even Ringo could find out by looking at him. She had the needle already threaded in the bosom of her dress. And I went back to the summer house, and then we came back to the house and up to the front door, and I waited for him to go into the hall, but he didn't. He just stood there, holding the nosegay in one hand and his hat in the other. Not very old. Looking at that moment, anyway, not very much older than Ringo and me, for all his braid and sash and saber and boots and spurs. And even after just 2 years looking like all our soldiers, and most of the other people, too, did, as if it had been so long now since he had had all he wanted to eat at one time that even his memory and palate had forgotten it, and only his body remembered, standing there with his nosegay and that beautiful girl look in his face, like he couldn't have seen anything even if he had been looking at it.
No, he said. Announce me. It should be your nigger, but no matter.
He said his full name, all three of them, twice, as if he thought I might forget them before I could reach the parlor.
Go on in, I said. They're waiting for you. They had already been waiting for you even before you found your pants were torn. Announce me, he said.
He said his name again.
Of Tennessee, Lieutenant, Savage's Battalion, Forrest's Command, Provisional Army, Department of the West.
So I did. We crossed the hall to the parlor, where Granny stood between Cousin Melisandre's chair and the table where the decanter of elderflower wine and three fresh glasses and even a plate of the tea cakes Lavinia had learned to make from cornmeal and molasses were sitting. And he stopped again at that door, too. And I know he couldn't even see Cousin Melisandre for a minute, even though he never had looked at anything else but her.
Lieutenant Philip, Saint-Just, back house, I said.
I said it loud, because he had repeated it to me three times so I would be sure to get it right, and I wanted to say it to suit him, too, since even if he had made us a good hour late for dinner, at least he had saved the silver.
"Of Tennessee,"
I said.
"Savage's Battalion, Forrest's Command, Provisional Army, Department of the West."
While you could count maybe five, there wasn't anything at all. Then Cousin Melisandre screamed. She sat bolt upright on the chair like she had sat beside the trunk in the litter of planks and shingles in the backyard this morning, with her eyes shut and her mouth open again, screaming. So we were still another half an hour late for dinner, though this time it never needed anybody but Cousin Philip to get Cousin Melisandre upstairs. All he needed to do was to try to speak to her again. Then Granny came back down and said,
"Well, if we don't want to just quit and start calling at supper, we'd better walk in and eat it within the next hour and a half at least."
So we walked in. Ab Snopes was already waiting in the dining room. I reckon he had been waiting longer than anybody, because after all, Cousin Melisandre wasn't any kin to him. Ringo drew Granny's chair and we sat down. Some of it was cold. The rest of it had been on the stove so long now that when you ate it, it didn't matter whether it was cold or not. But Cousin Philip didn't seem to mind. And maybe it didn't take his memory very long to remember again what it was like to have all he wanted to eat. But I don't think his palate ever tasted any of it. He would sit there eating like he hadn't seen any food of any kind in at least a week, and like he was expecting what was even already on his fork to vanish before he could get it into his mouth. Then he would stop with the fork halfway to his mouth and sit there looking at Cousin Melisandre's empty place, laughing. That is, I don't know what else to call it but laughing. Until at last I said,
"Why don't you change your name?"
Then Granny quit eating, too. She looked at me over her spectacles. Then she took both hands and lifted the spectacles up her nose until she could look at me through them. Then she even pushed the spectacles up into her front hair and looked at me.
"That's the first sensible thing I've heard said on this place since 11 o'clock this morning," she said. "It's so sensible and simple that I reckon only a child could have thought of it."
She looked at him.
"Why don't you?"
He laughed some more. That is, his face did the same way, and he made the same sound again.
"My grandfather was at King's Mountain with Marion all through Carolina. My uncle was defeated for governor of Tennessee by a corrupt and traitorous cabal of tavern keepers and Republican abolitionists, and my father died at Chapultepec. After that, the name they bore is not mine to change. Even my life is not mine so long as my country lies bleeding and ravished beneath an invader's iron heel."
Then he stopped laughing, or whatever it was. Then his face looked surprised. Then it quit looking surprised, the surprise fading out of it, steady at first, and gradually faster, but not very much faster, like the heat fades out of a piece of iron on a blacksmith's anvil, until his face just looked amazed and quiet and almost peaceful.
"Unless I lose it in battle," he said. "You can't very well do that sitting here," Granny said.
"No," he said, but I don't think he even heard her, except with his ears. He stood up. Even Ab Snopes was watching him now. His knife stopped halfway to his mouth with a wad of greens on the end of the blade.
"Yes,"
Cousin Philip said. His face even had the beautiful girl look on it again.
"Yes,"
he said. He thanked Granny for his dinner. That is, I reckon that's what he had told his mouth to say. It didn't make much sense to us, but I don't think he was paying any attention to it at all. He bowed. He wasn't looking at Granny nor at anything else. He said,
"Yes,"
again. Then he went out. Ringo and I followed to the front door and watched him mount his horse and sit there for a minute, bareheaded, looking up at the upstairs windows. It was Granny's room he was looking at, with mine and Ringo's room next to it, but Cousin Melisandre couldn't have seen him even if she had been in either one of them, since she was in bed on the other side of the house, with Philadelphia probably still wringing the cloths out in cold water to lay on her head. He sat the horse well. He rode it well, too. Light and easy and back in the saddle, and toes in and perpendicular from ankle to knee, as Father had taught me. It was a good horse, too.
"It's a damn good horse," I said.
"Get the soap," Ringo said. But even then I looked quick back down the hall, even if I could hear Granny talking to Ab Snopes in the dining room.
"She's still in there," I said.
"Ha!" Ringo said. "I done tasted soap in my mouth for a cuss I thought was a heap further off than that." Then Cousin Philip spurred the horse and was gone. Or so Ringo and I thought. 2 hours ago, none of us had ever even heard of him. Cousin Melisandre had seen him twice and sat with her eyes shut, screaming both times. But after we were older, Ringo and I realized that Cousin Philip was probably the only one in the whole lot of us that really believed even for one moment that he had said goodbye forever. That not only Granny and Luvinia knew better, but Cousin Melisandre did too, no matter what his last name had the bad luck to be. We went back to the dining room. Then I realized that Ab Snopes had been waiting for us to come back. Then we both knew he was going to ask Granny something because nobody wanted to be alone when they had to ask Granny something, even when they didn't know they were going to have trouble with it. We had known Ab for over a year now. I should have known what it was, like Granny already did. He stood up.
"Well, Miss Millard," he said, "I figure you'll be safe all right from now on, with Bed Forrest and his boys right there in Jefferson. But until things quiet down a mite more, I'll just leave the horses in your lot for a day or two."
"What horses?"
Granny said. She and Ab didn't just look at one another. They watched one another.
"Them fresh captured horses from this morning," Ab said.
"What horses?"
Granny said. Then Ab said it.
"My horses."
Ab watched her.
"Why?"
Granny said, but Ab knew what she meant.
"I'm the only grown man here," he said.
Then he said,
"I seen them first. They were chasing me before..."
Then he said, talking fast now. His eyes had gone kind of glazed for a second, but now they were bright again, looking in the stubbly dirt-colored fuzz on his face like two chips of broken plate in a worn-out doormat.
"Spoils of war. I brought them here. I told them in here. A military ambush. And as the only and ranking Confederate military soldier present..."
"You ain't a soldier,"
Granny said.
"You stipulated that to Colonel Sartoris yourself while I was listening. You told him yourself you would be his independent horse captain, but nothing more."
"Ain't that just exactly what I'm trying to be?"
he said.
"Didn't I bring all six of them horses in here in my own possession, the same as if I was leading them on a rope?"
"Ha!" Granny said. "A spoil of war, or any other kind of spoil, don't belong to a man or a woman either until they can take it home and put it down and turn their back on it. You never had time to get home with even the one you were riding. You ran in the first open gate you came to, no matter whose gate it was.
Except it was the wrong one," he said.
His eyes quit looking like china. They didn't look like anything. But I reckon his face would still look like an old doormat, even after he had turned all the way white.
"So I reckon I got to even walk back to town," he said. "The woman that would..."
His voice stopped. He and Granny looked at one another.
"Don't you say it," Granny said.
"No'm,"
he said. He didn't say it.
"A man of 7 horses ain't likely to lend him a mule."
"No," Granny said, "but you won't have to walk."
We all went out to the lot. I don't reckon that even Ab knew until then that Granny had already found where he thought he had hidden the first horse and had it brought up to the lot with the other 6. But at least he already had his saddle and bridle with him. But it was too late. 6 of the horses moved about loose in the lot. The 7th one was tied just inside the gate with a piece of plow line. It wasn't the horse Ab had come on, because that horse had a blaze. Ab had known Granny long enough, too. He should have known. Maybe he did. But at least he tried. He opened the gate.
Well, he said, it ain't getting no earlier. I reckon I better...
Wait, Granny said. Then we looked at the horse, which was tied to the fence. At first glance, it looked the best one of the seven. You had to see it just right to tell its near leg was sprung a little, maybe from being worked too hard too young under too much weight.
Take that one, Granny said.
That ain't mine, Ab said. That's one of yourn. I'll just...
Take that one, Granny said.
Ab looked at her. You could have counted at least 10.
Hellfire, Miss Millard,
he said.
I've told you before about cursing on this place, Granny said.
Yes'm,
Ab said. Then he said it again.
Hellfire.
He went into the lot and rammed the bit into the tired horse's mouth and clapped the saddle on and snatched the piece of plow line off and threw it over the fence and got up, and Granny stood there until he had ridden out of the lot and Ringo closed the gate. And that was the first time I noticed the chain and padlock from the smokehouse door, and Ringo locked it and handed Granny the key, and Ab sat for a minute looking down at her.
Well, good day, he said. I just hope for the sake of the Confederacy that Bed Forrest don't never tangle with you with all the horses he's got.
Then he said it again, maybe worse this time because now he was already on a horse pointed toward the gate.
Or you'll damn sure leave him just one more passel of infantry before he can spit twice.
Then he was gone, too. Except for hearing Cousin Melisandre now and then, and those six horses with U.S. branded on their hips standing in the lot, it might never have happened. At least Ringo and I thought that was all of it. Every now and then Philadelphia would come downstairs with the pitcher and draw some more cold water for Cousin Melisandre's cloths. But we thought that after a while even that would just wear out and quit. Then Philadelphia came down again, and came in to where Granny was cutting down a pair of Yankee pants that Father had worn home last time so they would fit Ringo. She didn't say anything. She just stood in the door until Granny said,
All right, what now?
She won't the banjo,
Philadelphia said.
What?
Granny said. My dulcimer? She can't play it. Go back upstairs.
But Philadelphia didn't move.
Could I ask Mammy to come help me?
No, Granny said. Lavinia's resting. She's had about as much of this as I want her to stand. Go back upstairs. Give her some more wine if you can't think of anything else.
And she told Ringo and me to go somewhere else, anywhere else. But even in the yard, you could still hear Cousin Melisandre talking to Philadelphia. And once, we even heard Granny, though it was still mostly Cousin Melisandre telling Granny that she had already forgiven her, that nothing whatever had happened, and that all she wanted now was peace. And after a while, Lavinia came up from the cabin without even being sent for, and went upstairs. And then it began to look like we were going to be late for supper, too. But Philadelphia finally came down and cooked it and carried Cousin Melisandre's tray up, and then we quit eating. We could hear Lavinia overhead in Granny's room now, and she came down and set the untasted tray on the table and stood beside Granny's chair with the key to the trunk in her hand.
All right, Granny said. Go call Joby and Lucius.
We got the lantern and the shovels. Then we went to the orchard and removed the brush and dug up the trunk and got the dulcimer and buried the trunk and put the brush back and brought the key into Granny. And Ringo and I could hear her from our room, and Granny was right. We heard her for a long time, and Granny was surely right. She just never said but half of it. The moon came up after a while, and we could look down from our window into the garden. At Cousin Melisandre sitting on the bench, with the moonlight glinting on the pearl inlay of the dulcimer, and Philadelphia squatting on the sill of the gate with her apron over her head. Maybe she was asleep. It was already late. But I don't see how. So we didn't hear Granny until she was already in the room, her shawl over her nightgown and carrying a candle.
In a minute, I'm going to have about all of this I aim to stand, too, she said. Go wake Lucius and tell him to saddle the mule, she told Ringo. Bring me the pen and ink and a sheet of paper.
I fetched them. She didn't sit down. She stood at the bureau while I held the candle, writing even and steady and not very much, and signed her name and let the paper lie open to dry until Lucius came in.
Ab Snope said that Mr. Forrest is in Jefferson, she told Lucius. Find him. Tell him I will expect him here for breakfast in the morning and to bring that boy.
She used to know General Forrest in Memphis before he got to be a general. He used to trade with Grandfather Millard's supply house, and sometimes he would come out to sit with Grandfather on the front gallery, and sometimes he would eat with them.
You can tell him I have 6 captured horses for him, she said. And never mind patter rollers or soldiers either. Haven't you got my signature on that paper?
I ain't worrying about them, Lucius said. But suppose them Yankees...
I see, Granny said.
Ha! I forgot.
You've been waiting for Yankees, haven't you? But those this morning seemed to be too busy trying to stay free to have much time to talk about it, didn't they? Get along, she said. Do you think any Yankee is going to dare ignore what a Southern soldier or even a patter roller wouldn't? And you go to bed, she said.
We lay down, both of us on Ringo's pallet. We heard the mule when Lucius left. Then we heard the mule, and at first we didn't know we had been asleep. The mule coming back now, and the moon had started down the west, and Cousin Melisandre and Philadelphia were gone from the garden, to where Philadelphia at least could sleep better than sitting on a square sill with an apron over her head, or at least where it was quieter. And we heard Lucius fumbling up the stairs, but we never heard Granny at all because she was already at the top of the stairs, talking down at the noise Lucius was trying not to make.
Speak up, she said. I ain't asleep, but I ain't a lip reader either. Not in the dark.
General Forrest say he respectful compliments, Lucius said. And he can't come to breakfast this morning because he gone to be whooping General Smith at Tallahatchie Crossing about that time. But providing he ain't too fur away in the wrong direction when him and General Smith get done, he'd be proud to accept your invitation next time he in the neighborhood. And he say, what boy?
While you could count about 5, Granny didn't say anything. Then she said,
what?
He say, what boy?
Lucius said. Then you could have counted 10. All we could hear was Lucius breathing. Then Granny said,
did you wipe the mule down?
Yes'm,
Lucius said.
Did you turn her back into the pasture?
Yes'm,
Lucius said.
Then go to bed, Granny said.
And you too, she said.
General Forrest found out what boy. This time we didn't know we had been asleep either, and it was no one mule now. The sun was just rising. When we heard Granny and scrambled to the window, yesterday wasn't a patch on it. There were at least 50 of them now, in gray. The whole outdoors was full of men on horses, with Cousin Philip out in front of them, sitting his horse in almost exactly the same spot where he had been yesterday, looking up at Granny's window and not seeing it or anything else this time either. He had a hat now. He was holding it clamped over his heart, and he hadn't shaved, and yesterday he had looked younger than Ringo because Ringo always had looked about 10 years older than me. But now, with the first sun ray making a little soft fuzz in the gold-colored stubble on his face, he looked even younger than I did, and gaunt, and worn in the face like he hadn't slept any last night, and something else in his face, too. Like he not only hadn't slept last night, but by Godfrey, he wasn't going to sleep tonight either, as long as he had anything to do with it. Goodbye, he said. Goodbye, and whirled his horse, spurring, and raised the new hat over his head like he had carried the saber yesterday, and the whole mass of them went piling back across flower beds and lawns and all, and back down the drive toward the gate, while Granny still stood at her window in her nightgown, her voice louder than any man's anywhere,
I don't care who he is or what he would be doing.
Back house! Back house! You! Back house!
So we ate breakfast early. Granny sent Ringo in his nightshirt to wake Lavinia and Lucius both. So Lucius had the mule saddled before Lavinia even got the fire lit. This time, Granny didn't write a note.
Go to Tallahatchie Crossing, she told Lucius. Sit there and wait for him if necessary.
Suppose they done already started the battle,
Lucius said.
Suppose they have, Granny said. What business is that of yours or mine either? You find Bedford Forrest. Tell him this is important. It won't take long. But don't you show your face here again without him.
Lucius rode away. He was gone 4 days. He didn't even get back in time for the wedding. Coming back up the drive about sundown on the 4th day with 2 soldiers in one of General Forrest's forage wagons with the mule tied to the tailgate. He didn't know where he had been, and he never did catch up with the battle.
I never even heard it,
he told Joby and Lucius and Lavinia and Philadelphia and Ringo and me.
If wars always moves that far and that fast, I don't see how they ever have time to fight.
But it was all over then. It was the 2nd day, the day after Lucius left. It was just after dinner this time, and by now we were used to soldiers. But these were different. Just 5 of them. And we never had seen just that few of them before, and we had come to think of soldiers as either jumping on and off horses in the yard or going back and forth through Granny's flower beds at full gallop. These were all officers, and I reckon maybe I hadn't seen so many soldiers after all because I never saw this much braid before. They came up the drive at a trot, like people just taking a ride, and stopped without trampling even 1 flower bed. And General Forrest got down and came up the walk toward where Granny waited on the front gallery. A big, dusty man with a big beard so black it looked almost blue, and eyes like a sleepy owl, already taking off his hat.
Well, Miss Rosie, he said.
Don't call me Rosie, Granny said. Come in. Ask your gentleman to alight and come in.
They'll wait there, General Forrest said. We are a little rushed. My plans have...
Then we were in the library. He wouldn't sit down. He looked tired all right, but there was something else a good deal livelier than just tired.
Well, Miss Rosie, he said, I...
Don't call me Rosie, Granny said. Can't you even say Rosa?
Yes'm, he said. But he couldn't. At least he never did. I reckon we have both had about enough of this. That boy...
Ha! Granny said. Night before last you were saying what boy? Where is he? I sent you word to bring him with you.
Under arrest, General Forrest said. It was a considerable more than just tired. I spent 4 days getting Smith just where I wanted him. After that... This boy here could have fit the battle. He said, fit for fought, just as he said druv for drove and drug for dragged. But maybe when you fought battles like he did, even Granny didn't mind how you talked. I won't bother you with details. He didn't know them either. All he had to do was exactly what I told him. I did everything but draw a diagram on his coattail of exactly what he was to do, no more and no less, from the time he left me until he saw me again, which was to make contact and then fall back. I gave him just exactly the right number of men so that he couldn't do anything else but that. I told him exactly how fast to fall back, and how much racket to make doing it, and even how to make the racket. But what do you think he did?
I can tell you, Granny said. He sat on his horse at 5 o'clock yesterday morning, with my whole yard full of men behind him, yelling goodbye at my window.
He divided his men and sent 1/2 of them into the bushes to make a noise and took the other 1/2, who were the nearest to complete fools, and led a saber charge on that outpost. He didn't fire a shot.
He druv it clean back with sabers onto Smith's main body, and scared Smith so that he threw out all his cavalry and pulled out behind it, and now I don't know whether I'm about to catch him or he's about to catch me. My provost finally caught the boy last night. He had come back and got the other 30 men of his company and was 20 miles ahead again, trying to find something to lead another charge against. "Do you want to be killed?" I said. "Not especially," he said. "That is, I don't especially care one way or the other."
"Then neither do I," I said. "But you risked a whole company of my men."
"Ain't that what they enlisted for?"
he said.
"They enlisted into a military establishment the purpose of which is to expend each man only at a profit. Or maybe you don't consider me a shrewd enough trader in human meat."
"I can't say," he said.
"Since day before yesterday, I ain't thought very much about how you or anybody else runs this war."
"And just what were you doing day before yesterday that changed your ideas and habits?" I said.
"Fighting some of it," he said. "Dispersing the enemy."
"Where?" I said.
"At a lady's house a few miles from Jefferson," he said. "One of the niggers called her Granny like the white boy did. The others called her Miss Rosie."
This time Granny didn't say anything. She just waited.
"Go on," she said.
"I'm still trying to win battles, even if since day before yesterday you ain't," I said. "I'll send you down to Johnston at Jackson," I said. "He'll put you inside Vicksburg where you can lead private charges day and night, too, if you want."
"Like hell you will," he said.
And I said, "Excuse me, like hell I won't."
And Granny didn't say anything. It was like day before yesterday with Ab Snopes. Not like she hadn't heard, but as if right now it didn't matter. That this was no time either to bother with such.
"And did you?"
she said.
"I can't. He knows it. You can't punish a man for routing an enemy 4 times his weight. What would I say back there in Tennessee, where we both live, let alone that uncle of his, the one they licked for governor 6 years ago on Bragg's personal staff now, with his face over Bragg's shoulder every time Bragg opens a dispatch or picks up a pen. And I'm still trying to win battles, but I can't, because of a girl. One single, lone, young female girl that ain't got anything under the sun against him except that since it was his misfortune to save her from a passel of raiding enemy in a situation that everybody but her is trying to forget, she can't seem to bear to hear his last name. Yet because of that, every battle I plan from now on will be at the mercy of a 22-year-old shavetail, excuse me again, who might decide to lead a private charge any time he can holler at least 2 men in gray coats into moving in the same direction."
He stopped. He looked at Granny.
"Well?"
he said.
"So, now you've got to it," Granny said. "Well, what, Mr. Forrest?"
"Why, I just have done with this foolishness. I told you I've got that boy in close arrest with a guard with a bayonet. But there won't be any trouble there. I figured even yesterday morning that he had already lost his mind. But I reckon he's recovered enough of it since the provost took him last night to comprehend that I still consider myself his commander, even if he don't. So all necessary now is for you to put your foot down. Put it down hard, now. You're her grandma. She lives in your home. And it looks like she is going to live in it a good while yet before she gets back to Memphis to that uncle or whoever it is that calls himself her guardian. So just put your foot down. Make her. Mr. Millard would have already done that if he had been here. And I know when. It would have been 2 days ago by now."
Granny waited until he got done. She stood with her arms crossed, holding each elbow in the other.
"Is that all I'm to do?"
she said.
"Yes,"
General Forrest said.
"If she don't want to listen to you right at first, maybe as his commander—"
Granny didn't even say, "Ha." She didn't even send me. She didn't even stop in the hall and call. She went upstairs herself, and we stood there,
and I thought maybe she was going to bring the dulcimer, too, and I thought how if I was General Forrest I would go back and get Cousin Philip and make him sit in the library until about supper time while Cousin Melisandre played the dulcimer and sang. Then he could take Cousin Philip on back, and then he could finish the war without worrying. She didn't have the dulcimer. She just had Cousin Melisandre. They came in, and Granny stood to one side again with her arms crossed, holding her elbows. "Here she is," she said. "Say it. This is Mr. Bedford Forrest," she told Cousin Melisandre. "Say it," she told General Forrest. He didn't have time. When Cousin Melisandre first came, she tried to read aloud to Ringo and me. It wasn't much. That is, what she insisted on reading to us wasn't so bad, even if it was mostly about ladies looking out windows and playing on something. Maybe they were dulcimers, too, while somebody else was off somewhere fighting. It was the way she read it. When Granny said, "This is Mr. Forrest," Cousin Melisandre's face looked exactly like her voice would sound when she read to us. She took two steps into the library and curtsied, spreading her hoops back, and stood up.
"General Forrest," she said, "I am acquainted with an associate of his. Will the general please give him the sincerest wishes for triumph in war and success in love from one who will never see him again?"
Then she curtsied again and spread her hoops backward and stood up and took two steps backward and turned and went out. After a while, Granny said,
"Well, Mr. Forrest?"
General Forrest began to cough. He lifted his coattail with one hand and reached the other into his hip pocket like he was going to pull at least a musket out of it, and got his handkerchief and coughed into it a while. It wasn't very clean. It looked about like the one Cousin Philip was trying to wipe his coat off with in the summer house day before yesterday. Then he put the handkerchief back. He didn't say ha, either. "Can I reach the Holly Branch Road without having to go through Jefferson?" he said.
Then Granny moved. "Open the desk," she said. "Lay out a sheet of notepaper."
I did, and I remember how I stood at one side of the desk and General Forrest at the other, and watched Granny's hand move the pen steady and not very slow and not very long across the paper, because it never did take her very long to say anything, no matter what it was, whether she was talking it or writing it. Though I didn't see it then, but only later, when it hung framed under glass above Cousin Melisandre's and Cousin Philip's mantle, the fine, steady slant of Granny's hand and General Forrest's sprawling signatures below it that looked itself a good deal like a charge of massed cavalry. "Lieutenant P.S. Backhouse, Company D., Tennessee Cavalry, was this day raised to the honorary rank of Brevet Major General and killed while engaging the enemy, vice whom Philip Saint-Just Bacchus is hereby appointed Lieutenant Company D, Tennessee Cavalry, N.B. Forrest, General." I didn't see it then. General Forrest picked it up.
"Now I've got to have a battle," he said. "Another sheet, son."
I laid that one out on the desk.
"A battle?" Granny said.
"To give Johnston," he said. "Confound it, Miss Rosie. Can't you understand either that I'm just a fallible mortal man trying to run a military command according to certain fixed and inviolable rules, no matter how foolish the business looks to superior outside folks?"
"All right," Granny said. "You had one. I was looking at it."
"So I did," General Forrest said. "Ha," he said. "The Battle of Sartoris."
"No," Granny said, "not at my house." "They did all the shooting down at the creek," I said.
"What creek?" he said.
So I told him. It ran through the pasture. Its name was Hurricane Creek, but not even the white people called it Hurricane, except Granny. General Forrest didn't either when he sat down at the desk and wrote the report to General Johnson at Jackson.
"A unit of my command on detached duty engaged a body of the enemy and drove him from the field and dispersed him this day, 28th ultimate April, 1862, at Harrikin Creek."
with loss of one man. N.B. Forrest, General.
I saw that. I watched him write it.
Then he got up and folded the sheets into his pocket and was already going toward the table where his hat was.
Wait, Granny said. Lay out another sheet.
She said,
Come back here.
General Forrest stopped and turned.
Another one?
Yes, Granny said. A furlough, pass, whatever you busy military establishments call them. So John Sartoris can come home long enough to...
And she said it herself. She looked straight at me and even backed up and said some of it over, as though to make sure there wouldn't be any mistake.
Can come back home and give away that damn bride.
And that was all. The day came and Granny waked Ringo and me before sunup and we ate what breakfast we had from two plates on the back steps. And we dug up the trunk and brought it into the house and polished the silver, and Ringo and I brought dogwood and redbud branches from the pasture, and Granny cut the flowers, all of them, cutting them herself with Cousin Melisandre and Philadelphia just carrying the baskets. So many of them until the house was so full that Ringo and I would believe we smelled them even across the pasture each time we came up. Though, of course, we could. It was just the food. The last ham from the smokehouse, and the chickens, and the flour which Granny had been saving, and the last of the sugar which she had been saving, along with the bottle of champagne, for the day when the North surrendered, which Luvinia had been cooking for 2 days now, to remind us each time we approached the house of what was going on and that the flowers were there, as if we could have forgotten about the food. And they dressed Cousin Melisandre and Ringo in his new blue pants and I in my gray ones, which were not so new. We stood in the late afternoon on the gallery, Granny and Cousin Melisandre and Luvinia and Philadelphia and Ringo and I, and watched them enter the gate. General Forrest was not one. Ringo and I had thought maybe he might be, if only to bring Cousin Philip. Then we thought that maybe, since Father was coming anyway, General Forrest would let Father bring him, with Cousin Philip maybe handcuffed to Father and the soldier with the bayonet following, or maybe still just handcuffed to the soldier until he and Cousin Melisandre were married and Father unlocked him. But General Forrest wasn't one. And Cousin Philip wasn't handcuffed to anybody, and there was no bayonet and not even a soldier, because these were all officers, too. And we stood in the parlor while the homemade candles burnt in the last of sunset in the bright candlesticks which Philadelphia and Ringo and I had polished with the rest of the silver, because Granny and Luvinia were both busy cooking, and even Cousin Melisandre polished a little of it, although Luvinia could pick out the ones she polished without hardly looking and hand them to Philadelphia to polish again. Cousin Melisandre in the dress, which hadn't needed to be altered for her at all because Mother wasn't much older than Cousin Melisandre even when she died, and which would still button on Granny too, just like it did the day she married in it. And the chaplain and Father and Cousin Philip and the four others in their gray and braid and sabers, and Cousin Melisandre's face was all right now, and Cousin Philip's was too, because it just had the beautiful girl look on it, and none of us had ever seen him look any other way. Then we ate, and Ringo and I, anyway, had been waiting on that for 3 days, and then we did it, and then it was over too, fading just a little each day, until the palate no longer remembered, and only our mouths would run a little water as we would name the dishes aloud to one another, until even the water would run less and less and less, and it would take something we just hoped to eat some day if they ever got done fighting to make it run at all. And that was all. The last sound of wheel and hoof died away. Philadelphia came in from the parlor carrying the candlesticks, and blowing out the candles as she came, and Luvinia set the kitchen clock on the table and gathered the last of soiled silver from supper into the dishpan, and it might never have even been.
Well,
Granny said. She didn't move, leaning her forearms on the table a little, and we had never seen that before. She spoke to Ringo without turning her head.
Go call Joby and Lucius.
and even when we brought the trunk in and set it against the wall and opened back the lid, she didn't move. She didn't even look at Luvinia, either.
"Put the clock in, too," she said. "I don't think we'll bother to time ourselves tonight."